live. Welcome to the Thank God for Bitcoin podcast. My name is Jordan Bush. I'm the executive director of TGFB Media, which exists to help Christians understand and use Bitcoin for the glory of God and the good of people everywhere. I am joined today by most of the regular casting crew of the Mountain Presbies. I'll let them introduce themselves.
My name is Tim Fox, executive director of the Magnolia Foundation. I am an ordained minister and also working with the Magnolia Foundation to teach the church how and why to use Bitcoin.
My name is Jim McAndrew. I work with Tim at Magnolia as tech support. I'm an entrepreneur, software developer, and an ordained deacon in the PCA Church in America.
My name is Ben Haley. I'm a pastor of Redeemer Presbyterian Church, College Station, Texas, and I also work with Magnolia as well.
Love it. Grateful for you guys. Glad you can be here. Basically, what we do every week is we spend time on Twitter, and so we want to redeem the Twitter time. And so basically what we do is we get together and we talk about things that we found helpful. Most of them will have tangential relation to Bitcoin. Again, we find ourselves as Bitcoiners, we consume a lot of Bitcoin content, whether it's people predicting price or talking about different ways and places where Bitcoin is being used. And yet at the same time, there's other things that we just realize that we need. And so some of these things that we'll talk about are directly related. Some of them are not directly related. So this episode, episode 33, entitled We Reap What We Sow, subtitle, which I didn't want to include for brevity, was basically, and that should either scare or encourage you. This can be, God has designed the world to work according to this principle of sowing and reaping. It can be a helpful, great thing, or it can be a thing that is terrifying and bad. And so what we want to do is we want to start up with a tweet that Tim shared. Let's see here. Well, Tim, this is the one with our favorite OpenAI guys. Do we want to listen to this full video? Great. Yeah. So Sam Altman, obviously founder of OpenAI, is sitting here talking about how great AI is and how important it is, and you know, giving himself. I think he's full of himself. So we have Lee Heppner, who observes, these guys have clearly convinced themselves that what they're doing is important beyond human comprehension, but are utterly incapable of communicating what it is. In another era, we'd call it a pyramid scheme or just idolatry. Tim.
Well, yeah, I mean, it's like a pyramid scheme and idolatry, theologically speaking, are the same thing. I mean, there's no greater rug pull than worshiping a false god in an eternal sense. And so, yeah, I mean, it's just, I don't know, you know, this is going to be evergreen probably for many decades to come.
Yep.
But this kind of utopian view of AI as the be-all and end-all, it's going to solve everything and fix everything amidst many concerns, to put it mildly, about what this means for us and our vocations and our relationships. But yeah, I don't know, just again, kind of Tower of Babel part 275,000 in the human story. Humans tend to be very confident about their ability to control the future and their ability to keep the genies in the bottle. And we should be praying for God's mercy in the midst of all this as it comes forward, and for people to wield these very powerful tools wisely.
Yeah, this is one of these things where, again, it's easy to point at them and go, yeah. It's easy to critique the AI guys because we're not AI guys. Right. Like, but I do think if we're going to use just weights and measures, which to Tim is a very important thing to talk about, if we're going to talk about that, we're going to use equal weights and measures to critique these things. I mean, I think there, we still ought to think about Bitcoin in this regard too. Right. Cause there, I mean, there, we can still think about a pretty dystopian way for, oppressive rulers to leverage what Bitcoin is against the people who use it, right? So like, I'm just imagining there could be some warlord who, in a feature where everybody has Bitcoin on their phone, he sets up a checkpoint, makes everybody pass through, and knowing that everybody's got their wealth on their phone, you know, like he could potentially do things like this.
Well, Jim and I just did a couple of talks on this idea of slavery. What does it mean to be a slave? Mm. What is the ultimate form of slavery? Biblically speaking, is being a slave to sin. And the ultimate redemption is being freed from sin. And that he and I were riffing on this quote from Augustine from, I think it's in the City of God, where he talks about how it's vastly worse to be the slave of a lust than the slave of a man. And how, you know, as bad as it is to have the AI overlords tyrannizing everyone and destroying their lives, it's actually much, much worse to be a slave to your own desires. Augustine, interestingly, you know, he's using lust broadly. He doesn't just mean sexual lust, although that's often prominent in his thinking.
Yeah.
He means in all, kind of all forms of desire. But what he specifies there in the next sentence is the lust to rule, the lust to be in charge, the lust to have power.
Yep.
And, you know, in that way, okay, let's imagine Sam Altman becomes the great tyrant who's destroying the world for his great ends. Who's in the worst situation? Well, Augustine would say it's Sam Altman is actually the worst slave that he knew.
Yep. Yeah, this is, it's also why, again, it's one of the reasons why when you see there's parts in the scripture we've talked about at different points about a biblical or Christian case for disobedience of rulers. You know, like there's, you can use the case of Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego in the Old Testament. Like, I think there's a pretty easy case to be made that they, like, their disobedience was the most loving thing that could possibly have happened to Nebuchadnezzar at that point. Because they loved him enough to not obey him and indulge his delusions that he was the God, that he was a God and deserving to be worshipped. And so I do think it's
the famous argument about what do you do if a crazed family member comes to you and asks for their gun back? You say no. The loving thing is to say no, absolutely not. You've lost the ability to use this.
Yep. Jim,
I would chime in here and say that the perspective that they can't explain it isn't exactly accurate, in my opinion. I think that they can explain it. I just don't think they want to say the quiet part out loud right now. I think what they do is they beat around the bush and they say things like, oh, it's going to be so great because it's going to cure all these diseases and end poverty and all this stuff. But their real motivation is they want to bring about the end of humanity, not necessarily in like a nefarious way where we're all getting nuclear bombs dropped on us and we all die. But it's effectively the same thing because the machine intelligence replaces human intelligence and it goes on to spread consciousness throughout the stars and blah, 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 whatever their woo-woo mystical vibes, God's vibration, spiritualism tells them, right? And so that's how they justify it in their minds. But they can't say that because if they say that, then all the humans will get scared, which is exactly what actually happened when Elon was at this dinner essentially with like Sergey Brin. I was just watching Preston Pysh and Seb just came out with an episode. They're kind of reviewing this book on Sam Altman, how OpenAI started. And they're talking about this little vignette where Elon is invited to this dinner party with Sam and Sergey and Larry. And they're all sort of talking about essentially the end of humanity. And Elon's kind of like, what are you guys talking about? That's crazy. And they all turn around and look at him and call him a speciesist or a speciist. I'm not sure how to pronounce it. And he's like, okay, yeah, I'm a speciesist. Yeah, I want humans to live. Great. So.
Yeah, it's I mean, it's just so unhinged. Like, this is one of these things where it's just so unhinged. But again, and so, but yet, why are people still going on with this, right? They're going a lot. Why are they pumping money into all these AI companies? Well, because the love of money is a root of all kinds of evil. Like, there's trillions of dollars to be made. And so that's why people are willing to look past all the dangers, willing to look past all these things, because there's the prospect of short-term gain.
In the short-term, for sure. But the long-term, they are attempting to transcend their humanity and get around having to believe in Christ in order to do that.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. So that's why this gets dark very quickly. It also, I mean, it exposes a whole host of heretical and like anti-reality views of people, why they exist, the nature of work, you know, to try to just get rid of these things. Like this is a different religion. Like this is,
I would quibble a little bit with what Jim just said. I don't think it's that you can only transcend humanity outside of Christ. It's that you can't transcend humanity. And that not even Christ wants you to transcend your humanity, and to try to do so is actually to become unhuman, like in Paralandria, the unman, become demonic. Mm-hmm. And so, yeah, to the extent that you are trying to get beyond your species or your nature, you are dissolving it and destroying it into something hideous while actually never getting beyond it.
And this is a political act. Like that's why, again, we have a couple tweets about Christians and politics coming up, but this is where again, this is not to say there's a difference between saying that Christians should be, especially pastors, should be super involved in politics. It's another thing to just acknowledge the reality that all of these kind of like that spiritual things are inherently political. Like there are inherently political beliefs and actions. Everything you're doing is political because it's all about power. Like everything that we're, you know, if Caesar is Lord, then Elon is not, or Sam Altman is not. And, you know, there's 100 ways in which this is true. And so, I think that the church has not done a good job of thinking through a lot of these issues. And so that's why we're part of the reason why we're in the situation that we're in. And so.
I want to unpack what I said just a little bit there, because I wasn't trying to imply that we're going to transcend our humanity ever. But I do have a question. The question is, when Jesus is going on about being one with the Father, and at some point he wants us to be one with him, like he's one with the Father. I think it's John 10, right? This whole monologue that he goes on. Do you see any parallels there with the transhumanist AI people and sort of wanting to upload their brains, become one with the super intelligence? Like, is that like an antichrist version of that vision of what Jesus is talking about? What does it mean to become one with the Father, like he's one with the Father?
I think it's not, we're not ever going to be one with the Father the way that Jesus is one with the Father, no matter what. It's more like the oneness of marriage, where husband and wife become one. That doesn't mean they become the same person, or they dissolve into a third nature or something like that, or the wife becomes the husband. It's more of a moral unity, I think, a unity of purpose and direction, an alliance of goals. You know, obviously Jesus in the context is talking about his disciples loving each other. He's not saying, I want to dissolve all of you into one blob so that you're all kind of the same thing now. It's only in kind of triune ultimate reality. God is Father, Son, and Spirit, but also always one. It's only in the Trinity that you can ultimately resolve this big question of how can things be united but also distinct from each other. And otherwise, I think we're always kind of falling off one side of the horse or the other in terms of dividing against each other or blending everything together like pagans do. And so, yeah, I think probably the transhumanists are leaning more towards the pagan side of things of let's blend it all together into one great consciousness, which is very scary from a Christian point of view.
Well, we have an example in fiction, the Borg in Star Trek, right? Picard gets subsumed into the Borg and he loses all sense of personal identity. What's that then?
Yeah, you will be assimilated.
Exactly. Resistance is futile.
So yeah, even in redemption, in the new creation, redeemed humans are as united as they will ever be. And there is, you know, no more fighting and arguments and screaming and yelling at your kids or your wife, and no more false attribution of motives. But people all remain distinct from each other, and they celebrate that, and they enjoy that about each other. And, you know, we'll be endlessly enjoying all these different people with all their unique perspectives. And I don't know. It's great. But all of that is, of course, in God and through God and his own, analogously, you know, his own unity and diversity.
Yeah, I think Jesus talked about a relational attunement there on a human level, as he's talking about as the Father and I are one in context of his disciples. We've been doing a series on relationships this fall, and our entire kind of starting point every single week is we start with the Trinity, and then how that unity and diversity in the Trinity fleshes out. And how do we image that as human beings in our different types of relationships, whether it be marriage, your neighbor, friendship, whatever it might be? Jim, I have a question based on, so I'm trying to, how does common grace factor into the way you're thinking about the AI, the emergence of AI and the potential for, you know, quote it, you know, ending humanity?
My eschatology doesn't really allow for humanity to be ended by AI.
I just want to make sure your eschatology is checking your, okay.
I actually,
true. I just wanted you to say it.
Yeah, I don't think we're all going to die from AI. I don't think the Lord is going to let that happen. I do think that the Lord could, I mean, through common grace, there could be lots of blessings and benefits that even the heathens get to enjoy.
And restraint. But, that's the particular thought I'm thinking about, is the restraint.
I feel like there could be a pretty big judgment, kind of Tower of Babel style version 275, like Tim was talking about. And so it's more just, do we really have to go through that again? I feel like the Lord has already taught us that lesson, but of course nobody reads the Bible or reads anything anymore. So, yeah.
All right, let's keep going here. On this, we'll stay on some of these notes. We mentioned politics. We mentioned the relationship between Christians and politics and how to think about this. We have a number of things. So let's see. We have our, every time we have Tim on, it seems like we get a tweet from James Wood. We need to get him on the episode or on the podcast here at some point.
I just don't want to follow that many people, and I'm lazy and just.
We totally should have him. I've been reading just about everything he's posting.
Yep,
because he's on our committee.
Cool. Yeah. The Christian Nationalism Committee for the PCA. All right. So James, friend of the program, says it's good for civil authorities / public figures to point the people to realities beyond politics, i.e. God. This helps people avoid the temptation of placing their ultimate hopes in politics. And so then actually here, we got Charlie Collier with a respectful pushback. Surely that depends on the nature of the pointing. Using God to enjoy the world, to speak in an Augustinian idiom, involves pointing to God. It just happens to be in an idolatrous fashion, to which James has another piece that he's written. Tim, what do you think?
I don't know. I just thought it was just a nice little quip. I think this was in the wake of the Charlie Kirk Memorial, which, you know, had a lot of people, you know, either completely gaga, this is the greatest thing ever, or this is the worst thing ever. And I mean, overall, I was very pleasantly surprised at how much Jesus appeared in it. And then to whatever extent, it was a Philippians 1 situation where people were disingenuously speaking of Christ for political aims. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. He was clearly being preached in many ways, and you should be glad about that, regardless of who was saying it or why they were saying it or how they were doing it. And as much cringe as there was theologically and ecclesiologically and politically, you know, there's a lot of things that, you know, I would not feel comfortable bringing that much kind of political grandstanding into a funeral, but it was like, wow. You know, I think James was trying to say it's good even from a political standpoint to point beyond politics. And I think I've heard a couple other people say something similar of when you don't explicitly talk about Christ's supremacy over these things, what you are actually encouraging and implying is that politics is the ultimate, and you kind of just leave people to figure it out on their own. Mm-hmm. And I think it's, even though it might be disorienting or disjointing to hear politicians or political leaders speak explicitly about Christ or about God and say, hey, this is what's ultimately important, we should be glad that they're saying it to whatever extent they actually mean it. Because ultimately politics is secondary to the ultimate redemption to come, even though there's a lot to do between what is happening in this world and the world to come, of course.
Weren't you saying that the Charlie Kirk Memorial may have been the largest gospel presentation in the history of the world?
Yeah, I mean, I don't know how they count these things in terms of, oh, we got, you know, 100 million viewers. And it's like, well, okay, I don't know what that means. That means counting everyone who watched it for 10 seconds. I mean, I just watched random clips of different parts of it. I didn't watch the whole thing. But if you kind of count that as people watching the memorial, then yeah, it's probably the largest evangelistic event in church history in terms of tens of millions or even hundreds of millions of people who heard about Jesus or heard the gospel.
Yeah, I agree with James. I think it is good for authorities and civil authorities, public figures, to point people to realities beyond politics, really, which means realities beyond themselves, like which is always a good thing that we, especially in the modern context where basically governments are treated like they are gods. You know, we think about them as not having any, not being accountable to anyone. At the same time, I think it's also good, without needing to be a third way, I feel like I think this is true, and especially in the context of the funeral, which you're correct, that is when this was posted, that is helpful. I think that's true. I think the bigger need at the moment, though, is for Christians to know it's for Christians to think rightly about political involvement. Specifically, I would emphasize local political involvement. Like, it's easy to just get stuck on the national stuff and then just become that become your whole diet. But like, I mean, Josh Howerton, I should find this tweet, but Josh Howerton, he's a pastor in the Southern Baptist Convention, I think. He's more of a megachurch pastor, but he's been kind of going on his own little journey and been really good the last few weeks, or like the last few months. He's just been willing to talk about these things in ways that are helpful. I gotta find this tweet. He was basically talking about reading a political book, reading a book by Christians from, I believe it was like the 17th or 1800s. And he was basically saying, like, man, every single one of these guys would have been slandered as a Christian nationalist, would have been, you know, considered as too political. These guys were doing election day sermons. These guys were super politically involved. The people he was reading, these were early Americans. And so I honestly think the bigger, like, obviously there's things that transcend politics. I don't think that's the big need that the vast majority of Christians have. I think that's the overwhelming position, at least in the circles that we run. I think the bigger need is to, like, think about, for Christians to think about and meditate on, like, what, like, actually involvement in politics as a way, like, political involvement as a way of faithfulness, as a way to be faithful to the Lord. That's not to say that I'm not talking about pastors necessarily. I'm just talking about your average Christian. I think there's the average Christian, their political involvement is I vote and then I might argue with somebody on Facebook about these things, when in reality, like, there's so much political stuff that could actually be useful that you can do on a local level that could be loving and serving your community in very real and tangible ways. That would give you opportunities to share the gospel. I don't think that what James articulated is the great problem of our area, of our era, even though I agree that it is a potential problem and there are people for whom it is a problem right now.
Glad we all agree.
I kind of speak to this in a couple of different ways. I mean, I definitely make a distinction between the church as an institution and Christians' involvement in these things. I do make that distinction. And, you know, I had quite a bit of conversation post Charlie Kirk events where that was kind of what I was emphasizing, was like, you know, hey, look, my job is to do my job and I represent the institution of the church. My political message, if you will, big C political message, you know, is that Jesus is Lord. And now what does it look like for you to steward, you know, that call to love your neighbor in this particular arena of, you know, College Station or Texas or the United States? Could be entering politics as a Christian. So I think that the just nagging thing I have there, as far as like the Kirk funeral, but really just that kind of just representative movement was, yes, Jesus was proclaimed. I really loved, honestly, Marco Rubio's. That was probably my favorite. But it still comes with this right-handed kind of power that I just don't see Jesus affirming in his kingdom building, you know, way. You know, even the disciples in Acts 1, they still think, after everything that had happened, they still think Jesus, establishing of Jesus' kingdom, really meant Israel taking over Rome. They still thought that in Acts 1. And he just basically was like, yeah, we ain't doing it that way. That's not how we're going to take over the world. Now, I think that was speaking to an institutional point there. Again, do I want Christians in politics seeking to implement beautiful laws, which we believe are God's good laws, for the flourishing of humanity? Absolutely. Please go do that. Right. So those are just kind of some of my thoughts. I think the power, the nature of the power, you know, I'm a big Capon fan, left-handed versus right-handed power, from his, parables book. And, Jesus is going about it a different way.
as far as church, kingdom, institution stuff. So,
yeah. And this is where I just think we don't want pastors to go like necessarily like pastors getting involved in like being politicians, right? Like we don't want that. Like well, pastors need to be pastors. Sure.
Unless they feel a
sure. But what I'm saying is the vast majority, like it seemed like the disciples were saying, hey, are you going to restore to Israel, restore the kingdom to Israel? So like, they're basically like, are we getting ready to reign? Are we getting ready to rule politically? And Jesus goes, he doesn't even answer him actually. And he basically, you know, goes on and he's like, no, effectively, no, like you guys are going to go disciple the nations. And so that's what you're called to do. And so, but again, at some point, this teaching them to observe all things that I have commanded you, which is part of, you know, Matthew 28, 19 to 20, is going to involve teaching like governing officials to obey Jesus because they are like, they have been they've been entrusted with political authority and they ought to steward it. You know, they ought to be taught what it looks like to steward it faithfully.
Go ahead, Tim. Sorry.
I was going to change subjects a tiny bit or add something.
Well, I just wanted to say real quick, one of the fun things when I was in my first call as a campus minister at Hines Community College was I had like 10 students, you know, and we just got started. And then the vice president of that particular campus, which is the largest campus, they were like 5 campuses, but she was the big dog. She just started coming to my Bible study. Mm-hmm. She's like, is this okay? I'm like, what are you talking about? She's like, this is my first calling to be a disciple of Jesus.
Yeah.
And I just felt honored, but I knew she was taking... her heart into her job, her Jesus formed heart in her job. Mm-hmm. I mean, I get stoked about that.
Yep. Yeah. I think the danger is, first of all, not knowing our own history, because like it's not like Christian political involvement and even like, you know, like explicitly talking about the scriptures at a political level. It's not like this is something new that we're just positing for the first time and like throwing out there as something like this is something Christians should do. This has been going on for like a couple thousand years. Like you're, you know, just shy of that.
Like, yeah. I mean, that is true, but I think it's a question kind of like James's tweet originally. I think it's a question of priority or mm-hmm. of what is foundational. And I, you know, one of the things I sent for us to discuss was this quote from Alan Jacobs. And I'll
read it because
this is related. The social media.
Can you share it on the screen, Tim? There we go.
Social media user's prayer. God grant me cacophonous wrath about the things I cannot change, habitual neglect of the things I can change, and absolute ignorance of the difference. One of my concerns in a social media, everything is on a super fast news cycle society is, I add on top of that, a society that since its foundation has been centrally concerned with political questions and political processes and political parties, is that people obsess over politics and they think that the political process is really where the real action happens, whether you're talking from the right or from the left. Mm-hmm. And a lot of these things, to your point, Jordan, about people obsessing over federal politics, which we really can't do much of anything about.
Mm-hmm.
To the neglect of local politics and the local community. Mm-hmm. I totally agree. People get obsessed with federal political issues and federal political questions. And then you add cocaine into the mix with social media and people are getting just wound up nonstop and really angry. And they're banging down the doors of their churches, demanding that their pastors speak to these things. Every, you know, sermon, you got to speak to the issues I want to hear about. Mm-hmm. But to get back to my earlier point of what is the ultimate priority? Yeah, Christianity is necessarily speaking to political questions. We don't just sit here and especially from the Reformed tradition, we don't just sit here and think about the Sermon on the Mount and say this is the be-all and end-all of we're just going to hide from the world and we're going to turn our cheeks and never let anything happen. No, there's a lot more going on in the New Testament and there's a lot more going on in the Old Testament that still matters and still applies. But there is a order of operations. There's a priority here. I was just reading the other night, Augustine, City of God. Okay, we're living in Christendom. Okay, we are 100, 200 years past Constantine. Christianity is the religion of the state. Augustine is not constantly talking in the City of God about, oh, isn't this great? Let's just go pedal to the metal, more politics. This is going to be great. He has a lot to say to political rule. But he keeps talking over and over and over again about how we're exiles, we're sojourners. And, you know, that can be overdone, of course. That can become an excuse for escapism and, you know, retreating into pietistic, you know, harmlessness. But I don't think we should completely ditch it. I think there is a point there that even when Christianity is on top of society, so to speak, like it was in Augustine's day, we are still sojourners. And Augustine is constantly pointing people to heaven, to the world to come. And suffering and evil and sin never let you forget about that. And sometimes I just, in a social media world, I get uncomfortable and I get concerned about people expecting too much too soon from politics, especially when someone like a Donald Trump, who is far more favorable towards kind of our brand of Christianity than other options would have been, Kamala Harris. I think it's a little too easy and tempting to think, oh, this is it. We've made it. Everything's going to be great. It's just going to be all uphill from here. And I want politics, like Ben was saying, I want politics to reflect Christ and honor Christ, but we have to keep what's ultimate. And you can argue that the New Testament was written in a context where they were on the bottom of society and they didn't have time to think about political questions, but I don't think you can deny that the apostles and Jesus did not seem to care that much about political questions in their day. And were not super uptight about speaking to all kinds of injustices that were going on. They had much bigger fish to fry. And I think we still do have much bigger fish to fry without saying politics is unimportant or Christians shouldn't be involved.
Yeah. So just to piggyback on that, I've been talking the last several weeks about felt needs versus real needs. So in a particular interaction I had with a congregant who needed me to speak to the Charlie Kirk situation from the pulpit, I said, what felt need would I be satisfying for you at that moment? I said, my job is the real need. And so I point to Ephesians 6, which is the evil behind the evil and all idolatry behind all of the evil in the world is what I'm going to continually pound on, whether we live in a more Christianized state or a less Christianized state. Calvin, the heart is a factory of idols. That's where I'm going to camp out, right? That speaks to that greater allegiance of the Lord Jesus as Lord of our hearts. I don't know if that's that language of felt need, real need, I think is big. You know, Henry Ford's supposedly quote of like, if you ask people what they need, they're going to say a faster horse, right? That's a felt need, but that wasn't the real need. And so I'm continually looking for, in all situations, what's the real need here? There's all of this, especially on social media, it's amplified, right? There's this need to speak to these things in such a way that if you're silent about these things, first of all, just read motives. And I just kind of had to say, I think I'm doing my job. I'm camping out on Ephesians 6. Oh, I'm fighting a war. I think I'm engaging in the spiritual battle that my calling as a pastor called to engage in. Does that have impact? Absolutely. I think it has impact in all areas of life, in your marriage, in politics, and all these things. Am I missing you somewhere there, Tim?
No, I think you're right. I mean, I think you would agree with this. I think there are times when you should and you'd need to speak specifically to serious, specific issues. You know, everybody, I think this is part of the dilemma is that everybody feels like their own time and their own age is uniquely troubled and things always used to be better and the world's about to end. I mean, Americans ought to do this. Christians ought to do this. The world's right about to end and unless we get the right people to fix things. I think I know the tweet you're talking about, Jordan, the guy talking about revolutionary era pastors speaking a lot about political issues.
Yep.
And it's like, maybe we're living in a time that is just as apocalyptic as that was, and therefore we should be speaking to these issues, but probably we're not. It's probably not as uniquely necessary for pastors to be totally dialed in into politics. If you just average out kind of, I mean, most Christians are going to live in relatively boring times where your main focus in church probably needs to be repentance, obedience, discipleship, which of course has all kinds of things to do with politics. But I don't know. I just think we need to be careful to think that, oh, well, my age is definitely the age where we're just as important as the revolutionary age was. And therefore I want to always be talking about politics.
Yeah. I guess my thing is I don't see people like it again. Maybe we're just, these are different circles. Cause again, this is possible. But like, my thing is, I don't think the problem is that Christians are too focused on politics. Like, I just don't think that's the issue. I think, again, you guys have all lived in Texas. Like, these people are 10 times more involved in sports than they are anything else. Like, I think Christians are, and I think more the people, especially Americans more broadly, I don't think the overwhelming thing is that people are too involved in politics. I think there's a small subset of people for whom that is their sports. Like, politics is their sports. But like, I just, and the people in my life, I don't have tons of people. I look around and I'm like, oh man, this guy's too focused on politics. Like, I think
you,
it's
you mean
that
involved, like they're actually involved themselves or obsessing with the news on Twitter?
Yeah. It, well, the latter, I guess. Like, I think that for a lot of people, it's been presented to them as more like they don't want to be, they, at least they're not doing that, or at least they're trying, they're aware of that danger. And so they're trying to be more pious by not being involved in politics. And that has its own negative downstream. So it's like the Lewis quote about bailing out the boat on one side, and then when really you should be bailing out the other side. I can't remember what the exact quote is, but like, that's, I guess that's the greater danger that I've seen that has resulted in us getting to the situation that we're in, is because people have been largely, it's like, that's, politics is too hard. Thinking about these issues, this stuff is too hard or too complex, or I just don't want to take the time to deal with it.
Jordan, you're probably right that your average Christian in the pew, their primary sin in terms of damage and the amount of time and energy they spend on it are probably things like pornography, you know,
sure,
sports, watching, yep, Netflix, being lazy, drinking too much, not eating well. Yeah, you're probably right. And I think that's generally what most evangelical pastors focus on in their sermons, are those kinds of things. And I hear them being criticized all the time on Twitter by people who are like, why don't we talk more about politics? You guys are just focused on this pietistic holiness stuff. And it's I think maybe where I'm coming from, and maybe Ben too, is that I do think there is a significant idolatry issue with politics among American evangelicals. Maybe not everybody, but a lot of them. And part of what makes it different than your average sins of gluttony or lust or whatever is that people who get wound up on politics and kind of fixate on it tend to be uniquely focused on other people in the church, what they think they should be doing and what they think they should be saying and what the pastor should be thinking and doing. And it kind of, I don't know, it's in a way it seems to multiply itself in some ways,
so maybe,
in ways that other sins don't.
Would you maybe say it is a smaller percentage of people, but they're just more vocal? Would you maybe say that is the issue?
That might be it, or it has more widespread pernicious effects in terms of I'm looking down on other people, I'm condescending towards other people, I'm a pain in the neck to my pastor and to my elders because they're not talking about it all the time like I want them to. You know, it's like, okay, if somebody's too obsessed with the 49ers and, you know, they just idolize the 49ers, okay, that's a problem. But, you know, they're probably not, you know, constantly demanding that the pastor denounce the Raiders fans from the pulpit, or that, you know, they're constantly, you know, hating them in their hearts and think these are just the worst people ever. But you do see that kind of thing, I think, in a way with politics and political idolatry.
Okay, yeah. I have a thesis just on a couple of notes. One, I think there's generational, it's generational. And here's where I sense myself turning as I'm now an empty nester, thinking more about the world that my children are going to live in. I know that like some of y'all think about that when they're younger, but I don't know why, but it has become more prominent for me in the last couple of years. And it kind of hinges around, you know, nostalgia is a dangerous friend, as you look back. Right. And, for example, you know, everybody's historically reconstructing the 80s, you know, for my generation, we're constantly historically reconstructing the 80s, for example. Of like, it was great. We didn't have any of these cell phones or any of this business, you know, and those sorts of things. But I'm just saying, I think that having been served in a primarily older congregation, and then now pastoring a congregation where I am one of the oldest, I might be one of the most, you know, conscious ones in my congregation now of like, of what the world is gonna be like. And I think it has a lot to do with my age, because when I was in the older congregation, I was one of the least, but it's all the older generation talked about. Mm-hmm. And they're not chiefly on social media. And so I think the ones that are saying this on social media, it feels like a different brand.
Yeah.
And I'm trying to figure it out. So,
yeah, I think here's what I think. I think that there are people whose motivation, like let's say pastors, there are pastors whose motivations for avoiding talking about politics is because they are laser focused on the Lord. They want to help their people focus on the Lord. I think there's another large segment of church leaders for whom avoiding talking about politics is avoiding making their own lives harder. Like, or potentially avoiding issues that could result in a divided church that could affect their bottom line of their church operating. And so like I think how you feel about this issue is somewhat determined by your own experience with maybe the church leaders in your life. It is one of these things where I don't know. I tend to, just given the breadth of things that are going on, like the breadth of the insanity, like there's part of me thinks like, again, it's not called for us to want to talk about politics. It's or to do whatever. It's called for us to be faithful with the things that we're, it's just with the situations that we're given. And so, you know, if some of the great trials of our era are basically, we've got laws that instantiate abortion. We've got laws that instantiate, you know, that we've got, what does it mean to be a man or woman? Can we, you know, can we do trans stuff? Like, it's going to come across as more political to speak, you know, biblically to these things. It's going to look more political compared to maybe what it's looked like, you know, in the past, couple decades or whatever.
Okay, I got a question, Jordan.
Yeah, do it.
I couldn't be less interested in politics, but I feel like, I mean, I'm a millennial, right?
Yeah.
I feel like the system has betrayed me and there's nothing there and it's totally corrupt. And then as a Bitcoiner, and you look at it through that lens, I guess like all the energy that I would have to care about and breathe into politics is getting sort of siphoned over into Bitcoin because I'm like, well, the system's not going to be able to be fixed from within the system. So we need this other thing to come and sort of topple the system to correct it. Right.
Yeah.
So are you saying like I should care more directly about politics as a Bitcoiner or as a Christian?
Yeah. So, I mean, this is part of how I think about this is the easier thing is just to check out and do nothing. Like that is just the easier thing. And I think there's tons of people who are in your situation where they like I would even like in terms of practically, like I haven't gotten super, I'm actually going to a political thing as soon as we're done recording this, but like, I'm not some super active person. And yet at the same time, like I look at it and I'm like, man, like the reason why there's garbage in a lot of these leadership positions in our city. And then at another level is just because the good people, let's call them like the righteous people, are more involved and more interested in, and again, things that they really ought to be. Like they're involved in, they want to give their time and their energy to good stuff. And so it just leaves these positions open to people who aren't good people.
See, but and the narrative I tell myself is I'm not doing nothing. I'm, instead of voting at the ballot box, I'm voting with my dollars to defund their system.
I think Bitcoin is very, very political.
Yes, 100. And this, okay, let me.
Very political.
What I'm not saying is that Bitcoin is not political and that you're not doing something about it by owning Bitcoin. I own Bitcoin. I own almost all Bitcoin. So like, I definitely think that is very political. I think that that's very helpful. And I love it. The fact that, yes, I'm having this deleterious effect on the, you know, nation state by just something as simple and as non-committal as just buying Bitcoin. But what my point is like this, there's a part of this non-committal attitude that a lot of Christians have that is just laziness. And it is just, it's like, it's desiring to not have to do inconvenient things.
It's because we all have plenty of money.
Yeah.
Well, I mean, honestly, it's,
yeah. Yeah. Well, that's the thing. That is
entering into a mass, you know, a wholesale Great Depression. Everyone becomes political.
Okay. Yeah. So that's,
dude,
that's
part of it. Even in our broken fiat money system, we are still the richest country in the world by magnitudes. And so everybody's pretty comfortable. Even you say, well, Ben, you know, this part of the population, I'm just saying when you go to foreign countries, even just a small one bedroom, two bedroom house, you know, in a tough neighborhood.
Yep.
That a lot of people feel like, hey, we're doing fine. But if you wipe out the money.
Okay. But this is an honest question. Do you think that voting, like for real voting at the ballot box, isn't anything more than a rounding error versus voting with your dollars by selling dollars?
But what I'm saying is, I'm not saying either or. I'm saying both and. I'm saying,
well, it's okay, fine. But it's like, if I'm getting 99.9% of all the impact and benefit out of voting with the dollars, why go waste half of my time on this political process if I'm like spending the same amount of time on both of them, but one of them's giving me like two orders of magnitude less impact? Why bother?
But you would vote for a Christian Bitcoiner in a heartbeat.
It's fine. I like, and I did, I actually did go vote for the first time in like a decade in this last, you know, nationwide election or whatever.
But this is our point. This is what we're saying. We're not talking about necessarily at the national level. Like what I'm saying is, like, again, like there are tons of ways in which you can get involved, like politically. Like, yeah,
it's happening locally too, Jordan, with the exposure of what a lot of school boards and city councils.
Correct. Right. Like that's a great example where it's like, hey, this is just a real practical way that a lot of the reality is a lot of these people in positions of power are cowards and they will fold like a cheap chair. If you literally went to a school board meeting and said something, like you're putting pressure on them. And so,
I vote to defund those systems by homeskooling, right? Like, so I,
both and, Jim, both and.
Okay, but obviously there's like, you only have a certain amount of time, right? So it's like, if you're going to be leading a small group, or you're going to go to a session meeting as an elder, or you're going to go do like a shepherding call, or you're going to show up at the hospital to pray for somebody versus go to a school board meeting. Yeah. I mean, you can't do both.
But this is why I'm saying I'm not advocating necessarily for pastors or for other church officers. Jim, if you're bound and determined to get off the hook, the deacons don't have to go either, even though they're supposed to serve. But we won't,
voting took like 30 minutes one day. I'm talking about just this idea that you're constantly showing up to rallies and Charlie Kirk, Point USA rallies.
This is, I guess what I'm saying is, I'm not saying everybody has to be Charlie Kirk. Okay. But there needs to, like, but having a lot more, maybe a lot, like, what would it be? It'd be twice as many people. If we had twice as many Charlie Kirks, like it'd be a better place. Cause a lot of this is, and you heard JD Vance talk about this at Charlie Kirk's memorial thing. He's like, I have talked more about my faith in the last week than in the rest of my political career. And like a lot of these guys in politics, they are Christians, but they're terrified because like they're terrified to talk about it because the presumption is, oh, like there's so many people out there. People are you know, quiet about their Christianity. And so like, I don't know. I just think like there's an opportunity here to do a lot of good. And basically, I mean, I think about like Bunyan, John Bunyan, he basically, his church pleaded with him to be their pastor. And he's like, I don't want to be your pastor. And they're like, no, please be our pastor. And so he ended up being their pastor. I think there's a lot of Christians who, like, again, it's not the easiest thing. It's not going to be the most fun thing, but like, whether it's local, whatever it is, just, and again, it doesn't have to be direct politics. If it's just putting pressure in different places, I think that we have again, authority that has been entrusted to us that we have the opportunity to do good with that goes beyond what I think Tim's point is. I'm not just talking about tweeting about it. I'm talking about like, listen, there's many more ways that you can actually affect real change than just yelling at somebody on Twitter.
I think my only point was just, if we could convince everybody to vote for such and such candidate or go to such and such school board meeting, just we could convince everybody to do one thing.
Yeah.
If the thing that we could convince them to do is sell dollars for Bitcoin, that would have the most impact.
Yes. Okay. Yes, everyone who's listening to this, probably all 350 people who will watch this, go buy Bitcoin if you're not already doing that. Okay, so yes, we agree. People should be buying Bitcoin. We agree.
Okay.
All right, how much time we got? We got like 1 minute here.
Tim wants in.
Do it, Tim.
I was going to say, for our ending, at this great little prayer that I posted in the chat from the Presbyterian Family Devotional from 100 years ago, praying for the family. I just thought it was a cool little prayer.
Oh, wait, where'd it go? I don't see it. Which chat did you put it in?
The Twitter one.
Oh, the Twitter one. Oh,
I think it's the first one I did.
Here, read it for us.
Okay, is this it? Are we ending with this prayer?
Yeah, we're ending with this prayer. Do it.
Okay, we're going to pray this. This is a prayer I think originally written for families, but we're going to pray it for Bitcoiners and all of their endeavors in this world. God of our fathers, we seek thy holy help in our effort to create a home on earth which shall fit us for our home in heaven. Mm-hmm. Enable us to make it the abode of peace and love, of truth and justice, of righteousness and honor. whether assembled about the family altar, the fireside, or the table spread with our daily bread, whether asleep beneath the sheltering roof by night or abroad and at work by day, may we feel that thou art round about us as the mountains are round about Jerusalem. May there here be pure joys which shall find expression in music and in laughter, and if tears must sometimes fill our eyes, may we learn to find the comfort of thy love. In sickness and in health, in joy and in sorrow, in life and in death, we crave and invoke thy blessing in the name of Jesus Christ. Amen.
Amen. That's a good word. Appreciate you guys, Jim, Tim, Ben. Grateful for you. Grateful for you guys who are listening to this. If you have liked what you've heard, or if you haven't liked, tell us about it. Leave a review. Leave a comment on YouTube. Leave a comment on Twitter. Cuss us out. Give us an, you know, just destroy us. It'll be great. Any attention is good attention. We will be back on Tuesday with another episode. We are going to be recording some really cool episodes in the near future here. It looks like we're going to hopefully get an interview with Rusty Reno, who's the editor of First Things magazine. We're going to talk to him about his book, what is it called? The Return of the Strong Gods. We've got hopefully an interview with Megan Basham coming up as well. Some other ones that are going to be real fun. So we'll keep you posted. And again, Bitcoin, where are we at right now? 121,000. We didn't even talk about it being all-time high the other day. This is some wild days, all-time high gold.
I'm scaring people because our Blocktrons don't agree.
Yeah.
People are going to zoom in on mine and be like, what universe do you live in?
Jim is in the future where Bitcoin is at 918,000. It's great. But anyhow, we appreciate you guys, and we will see you on the next episode of the Thank God for Bitcoin podcast.